theory in inflation using quantum mechanics. And of course, this, according to the theory of inflation, these fluctuations had their origin in the entanglement present in the quantum field theory vacuum. And interestingly, this theory of inflation magnifies those tiny fluctuations. And now we see that the structure of the universe at long distances is governed by these fluctuations. Well, at least that's one way to explain these fluctuations. And of course, these fluctuations are seen in the CNB. So what we see in the CNB is really those initial fluctuations, which were scaling, almost scale invariant, processed with some extra physics afterwards. We will not talk about the physics afterwards. That physics is mostly responsible for a spectrum. So if you had just the primordial fluctuations, you would have a spectrum here, a horizontal line here on this figure. But there is some physics about oscillations of the protons and so on, which produces these peaks. We will not discuss these peaks at all. We'll discuss the scale invariant primordial fluctuations. And in the afternoon, you will be making some little plots of these fluctuations using the calculations we'll discuss today, we'll discuss right now, the quantum mechanical calculations based on the quantum field theory vacuum during inflation. And you'll be able to compare the pictures you see from, these are little snapshots from the CMB focusing at the scales where the power is maximal, where those peaks were present, and you can draw similar plots in your computer. And so I think this is a really interesting topic where quantum mechanics and gravity come together. And it's a striking example where quantum mechanics really tells us what the shape of space-time is. So you can actually produce a picture in your computer of the shape of space-time, the shape of the universe at very long distances, right? It's a little bit like Kepler's dream, where Kepler was trying to fit the planets into regular solids, finding regular geometric structures in the universe, or the, what was considered the time the universe, which was just the solar system. And now we have a similar theory that predicts the shape of the universe. It's not a theory that predicts a unique shape. It just predicts the statistics of the shape. And it is a fractal shape, a scale invariant shape, essentially. And all you need to know to derive it is harmonic oscillators. So we'll go over the theory of that shape of the universe. So I think this is one of the triumphs of theoretical physics, to be able to compute the shape of the universe from harmonic oscillators. So what I'm discussing right now, so I'll be discussing these things just as a historical note. These fluctuations were computed in the 80s by various people. The first ones to do the calculation were Starobinsky and Mukhanov for a very specific model, for the Starobinsky model of inflation. And then they were done by various other groups, including Hawking, Guth and P, Bardeen, Steinhardt, and Turner, and then further refined in the intervening years. Okay, so before we talk about the fluctuations, so some basic features about the background universe where these fluctuations will be happening. So a few things about the Sitter spacetime. Can everyone read this? Yeah. Oh yeah. So we can turn this off. This was just some motivation. Okay. So the Sitter space. So the Sitter space is a universe which expands with constant acceleration. So we have an expansion rate which is exponential. So the scale factor of the universe grows exponentially. This time coordinate is called proper time. And it's sometimes convenient to write this in terms of something which is called conformal time. which is simply a coordinate transformation where this eta, well, 1 over eta squared is the same as this factor. So that's the coordinate change. And so that's the coordinates we'll use. These are convenient for understanding the Penrose diagram because we can, when we draw the Penrose diagram, we can just forget over all factors in the metric or to understand the causal structure of this space-time. So the infinite future is at eta equal to 0, and then eta is negative, so it comes from minus infinity to eta equal to 0. So eta equal to 0 corresponds to infinite time in the future. So it takes an infinite. So if you are an observer sitting here at some fixed x position, if you sit at a fixed x position, you will be a geodesic observer, so you will be feeling no force. Sometimes these are called comoving coordinates. These are the coordinates of a particle at rest. And any particle, even if it's moving, it will, in these coordinates, it will tend to have a fixed x position. And if you are such an observer, you will only be able to see this region of the space-time, right? Because any point that is outside this cone cannot send a signal to you before time equal to infinity. Another way of saying this is that this point is moving further, faster than the speed of light. I mean, that's sometimes said. I don't like that way of saying it. But, well, maybe I shouldn't even have said it if I don't like it. okay, so that's the Sitter space. And we will be considering a scalar field in the Sitter space. Maybe I should mention that, well, as a side comment, there are different coordinates. Sometimes people, you can choose some coordinates where the Sitter space looks static. And in those coordinates, we have a time translation symmetry. Maybe I should even write the coordinates. So these are the coordinates in the static patch. So these coordinates cover this region. And the point of writing these coordinates is to notice the similarity to black holes, because here, this point where r, where this g00 becomes equal to 0, this time coordinates, yeah. So where when G00 becomes 0, we have a horizon. That's the cosmological horizon. Everything that is behind the horizon cannot send the signal to this observer, right? So, and we'll see that the effect that we are talking about, so these quantum-generated fluctuations, are intimately connected with Hawking radiation. So they're basically the same phenomenon. And so it is not a stretch to say that Hawking radiation has already been seen in the CMB. Then there is also another system of coordinates where, which we normally call global coordinates. And in that system of coordinates, we have a three-sphere times time. So this is another time coordinate plus cosh square of tau, d omega 3 squared. And this in this system of coordinates, this covers all of the Sitter space, and this system of coordinates covers only this upper part. And in cosmology, we think that this region of the Sitter is mostly relevant, and we normally don't consider the region here into the past where the universe expands into the past. I won't discuss why we. Well, one reason to not consider this is because we think that this would be part of some more complex evolution, where there maybe have been a bubble nucleation event in the past, and in such events, we only get the future part of the Sitter. But well, that there are people also who try to understand all of the Sitter space, but it's a little more confusing. So we'll just concentrate on this patch of the Sitter space, the expanding universe. Okay, so now we'll consider a scalar field in the Sitter space. So we'll have a scalar field whose action is the integral of gradient of phi squared, where this gradient is with the background metric given by these coordinates. And we can write this explicitly. And so we have 1/2 integral d eta d3x, 1 over eta squared minus d eta phi squared minus dx phi squared. Okay. So we had so we have a factor of eta squared because we had 4 factors of 1 over eta from the square root of g, and then a factor of eta squared in the numerator from the inverse metric. Okay, that is present here to contract this indices. So that's the action. And because we have translation symmetry in the x coordinates, we can go to Fourier basis. And so we can rewrite the same action in Fourier space, where we have d eta over eta squared. So d3k over, well, I'm going to put the factors of 2 pi, but I think at some point you probably should do this computation understanding all the factors of 2, because it's a pretty fun calculation. So for each Fourier mode, then we have an action, which is the action of a harmonic oscillator. So this is, if we didn't have this factor here, this would be the action of a harmonic oscillator. So that's the promise harmonic oscillator. I told you that you would be able to understand the shape of the universe using the harmonic oscillator. Here, each harmonic oscillator is each mode of the field. And what is this eta square factor in front? Well, you can think of this as a harmonic oscillator whose mass changes with time, but fixed frequency. Or you can think of this as a harmonic oscillator where h bar is changing in time, and it's very quantum mechanical at very early times when eta is very large, and becomes very classical at late times. We'll make this statement a little more concrete later. But so how do we deal with these harmonic oscillators? Well, first of all, we can look at the solutions of the classical equation. So let's just consider not the quantum problem, but the classical problem, and solve the equations of motion for this harmonic oscillator. And we find that the equations of motion have some simple solutions, which are of the form 1 minus ik eta e to the I k eta. And then, of course, the complex conjugate solution, which is phi star, which is 1. Well, of course, the complex conjugate of this. And the reason I'm just writing it, this is not just to be only pedantic, but just to say that this is a basis of 2 linearly independent solutions of the equation. So any solution of the equations of motion can be written as a combination of these 2. OK, so now let's go to quantum mechanics. So in quantum mechanics, we'll have this field phi's. Will be operators, and we will be interested in the operator equation of motion, which will be equal to the classical equation of motion. And we can expand the operator, therefore. So the operator, this is now the field operator for each k mode, as a function of eta, can be expanded in terms of these classical solutions. So we'll have some, let's see. So we'll have the phi k solution. So this is the classical solution. Maybe I should call it classical here, just to make sure that we are talking about the classical solution. And the prefactor is some operator, which we are going to call a dagger. And then there will be some other operator, which we'll call b, times the other combination. So for now, a dagger and b are just 2 operators. Which the 2 coefficients, 2, let's say, complex coefficients of these 2 solutions. Notice that each Fourier mode is a complex harmonic oscillator. And we, therefore, have 2 independent coefficients in front of the 2 solutions. So then we demand that we obey the canonical commutation relations. So we know that the pi, so the canonical momentum conjugate to phi, should be I, right? So that's the canonical commutation relation. And pi is the derivative of the Lagrangian with respect to d eta of phi, right? And so we can come here to the Lagrangian and find exactly what it is, right? So it's a simple calculation. And you demand that the commutation relations are obeyed. And what you find is that the result of this computation is that A with A dagger should... I've omitted one little step. But okay, I'll fix it in a second. And B dagger is equal to 1. Okay, so that's the story. Of course, we have of course this operator, and we have its complex conjugate, which will be given by complex conjugate in this, and will replace the A dagger by A and the B dagger by B, and it's that complex conjugate that appears in pi, right? Because when we take the derivative with respect to the time derivative of this, we get the complex conjugate, and that's the reason why we get A and A dagger and B dagger in this formula. Okay? Is that clear? Yeah. Notice that if we had some other factor here, if I put a constant here, that constant will certainly appear when I consider the pi, right? And if we want this to be normalized to 1, then I will have to put this constant here in front, right? And so if we want to do this with all the constants, then of course we can say, well, I set A always to have this commutation relation, and then I absorb any constant in my definition of these classical solutions. And if you do that, then you find that if you work through this, you find that the constants that you need to put are 2k cubed here, and, well, of course, the same constant here. Now, this 2k cubed is not very difficult to understand. I mean, we take, let's say, eta to be very large, right? So if we take eta to be very large, then the oscillation frequency is much, so the period of oscillation is much shorter than eta, so I could consider eta to be a constant for that, those purposes. And in that case, we find that, so similarly in this formula, if eta is very large, I can just neglect the variation of this. And so that constant eta here is just the same as this constant here. We are simply removing that constant by canonically normalizing the field. That's this factor of eta. And then the factor that we get in front is a factor of 1 over square root of k, which is the same factor we normally get for a harmonic oscillator. So for harmonic oscillator field operator, we have this 1 over square root of omega. Okay, so that was just to connect to what you might have seen. If not, it's not a complicated calculation. Okay, so that's all, but I haven't explained yet why we are calling this A or A dagger, and why we use this notation. So the thing is that this so far defines the operator, but we need to define a state, the vacuum state, or we need to define the state of the field. And the idea is that we'll define a certain vacuum state. And the way we'll define it is such that at very short distances, we have the ordinary Minkowski vacuum. So notice that if we consider a fixed distance scale here, so if we have two observers who are separated by a fixed distance, so this is the same delta x. Delta x is, of course, not the proper distance, but it's just some coordinate distance in coordinate choices where we choose them so that these two observers just move forwards in time. No. And when we go to very early times, this factor becomes very, very small. And so this distance becomes very, very small. So at very early times, a fixed x distance becomes a very short distance in spacetime. Now, here we did a Fourier transform in x, in the coordinate x. So, I mean, if I were to include the x dependence, this would be e to the ikx, right? No factors of eta here. So what that means is that we are considering modes with a fixed wavelength. So we have modes which, so if this was the Penrose diagram we were drawing before, we started with some mode that has some fixed wavelength. We can go to, and this wavelength is the same at very early, the wavelength in the x coordinates is the same at all times, right? But when we go to a very early times, this wavelength is much smaller than the physical wavelength, is much smaller than the radius of the sitter. And so this corresponds to a mode that, for an observer in the sitter space, would be a mode that is very similar to the mode in Minkowski space, the same corresponding mode in Minkowski space. And so we'll assume, as we normally assume in Minkowski space, that we have a state that looks like the vacuum for that observer. So it's a state that would look like an observer, that would look like a vacuum for an observer that was living at that time. And what that means is that when we quantize, we quantize the system, we choose the A and A dagger so as to annihilate the vacuum, right? And of course, B also annihilates the vacuum. So here, the A's will be, so if we look at very early times, as I said, it's the same as having a harmonic oscillator. And then we choose the A's and A daggers in the same way that we choose them for a harmonic oscillator, right? So we can neglect this very early times. We can neglect the time dependence of these factors. And we define the operator A to annihilate the vacuum. And the operator that does so is the operator that is multiplied here in the solution by the term with a definite frequency. So in this case, it's the term with that oscillates like e to the minus ik eta. OK, so that's how we choose the vacuum. Yes? Exactly, yeah. So when eta, yeah, it's very large and negative, this oscillates much more rapidly than the amplitude is changing. Or even if we go to the original metric, this scale factor is contracting at a rate which is smaller compared to this to the size, and we can use the adiabatic approximation or the WKB approximation. So this is the same as using the WKB approximation at early times. So if we wrote the equation of motion that comes from this action, it looks like, it's a wave equation, right? It corresponds to, maybe I should write that. Should I write this explicitly? Is this? Where is the erase? Oh, I can continue here. Exactly, yeah. So when for very early times, this frequency here is much larger than the variation of this overall constant, than the fractional variation of this overall constant. So that's per unit frequency. That's the adiabatic condition. Okay, so let's just simply write the wave equation such for completeness. So that's the equation we are solving, right? And we can expand this and say that this is the same as d eta squared minus 2 over eta d eta phi plus k squared phi is equal to 0, right? And so for very large eta, we just simply neglect this factor, right? This looks very similar to when we expand the wave equation in, radial cylindrical coordinates, we get a term like this, so we neglect this at very large eta. And then we get the simple solution that phi goes like e to the I kx, k eta, okay? And normally when you do WKB approximation, then you can improve it a little bit to get the prefactor, and that gives you that you can do by, and you can get this prefactor in general. So in fact, this same technique works for any function of eta that you had here in front. You would make the same approximation. You will have this e to the ik eta, and then here in front, you'll get the function, which is the function you get here is related to this function. You can find that relation in general from this WKB approximation. So I think this afternoon you'll be solving this type of equations with slightly more complicated functions. Good. So now the interesting thing is to evaluate the two-point function at late times. So we, in principle, we can calculate the two-point function at any time. So we can take the field operator at let's say the same time. We could put different times here, but let's say we put it at the same time. And here, so we will be putting here expressions similar to what I, well, exactly the same expression that we wrote over there. And so the B, for example, will be annihilating the vacuum here on the right. So we'll only get the A dagger here. And we have the opposite situation here, so that we only use the commutation between A and A dagger. And in the end, we get simply the coefficient of that A dagger term squared. And that's easy to do, so 1 plus. So we can do it for general. So we use now the classical solutions we wrote over there to find this expression. And so at late times, so that late times means that eta goes to 0. We can neglect this because what is, notice that here for eta much smaller than k, this factor will drop out and we'll get 1 over 2 k cubed. So let's try to understand what it means for this factor to be of order 1 when we have this transition from this becoming time independent to being time independent. So that occurs when, so k is roughly the inverse of the wavelength, right? So saying that k eta is of order 1 is more or less the same as saying that the wavelength is of order eta, right? So in the picture that we're drawing over there, so we have following the, let's say, a mode with a given wavelength, right? And so we follow it in time, and at some point it crosses this horizon, the cosmological horizon, where this comoving wavelength, which is fixed, the proper wavelength is very small, starts very small. The proper distance corresponding to this wavelength is very small here. Here is equal to the size of the horizon, and for later times it's much bigger than the size of the horizon. And this comes on, since this is a 45-degree angle line, it doesn't look like that in the figure, but that's some gravitational distortion here. So this is a 45-degree angle, so it comes for an eta which is of order the wavelength, right? So when eta is of order the wavelength, this mode crosses the horizon, or equivalently, when k eta is of order 1, we are crossing the horizon. When k eta is much more than 1, then this mode has a size much bigger than the size of the horizon at the time. Okay? And remember that eta is exponential in the proper time. So here in this figure, this whole region looks very small, but it's a lot of time, and there's a huge rescaling happening there. Right? It's a very distorted figure. Okay. So this shows that this amplitude becomes constant at late times, and it stays constant, of constant value. So once you establish the specific fluctuation here, it will remain until the end of this expansion period. Okay. Now, another point that is interesting is the following. So you can calculate the conjugate momentum from there. And of course, the commutation relation between pi and phi will always be of order 1. But the commutation relation between pi and the proper time derivative of phi, okay? This is not the canonical momentum because there are some factors of eta in front. And in fact, if you compute this, this goes like eta cubed, okay? And what you see is that if you normalize this correctly, there will be a k cubed. So this commutator becomes of order one when you cross the horizon, and then becomes much more than one. We can interpret this as saying that the field becomes classical, in the sense that, of course, the commutator of the field with its canonical momentum would always be of order one. But what we can easily measure is the field and its proper time derivatives. So that those are the things that will govern the evolution, or we can see by making observations in the late universe. This doesn't follow, obviously, from what I'm saying, but there is something extra we need to know. And once we know that, we know that we should try to understand what the commutation relations between the observable, more easily observable quantities are. And we see that the commutation relations are such that this is becoming zero exponentially fast. Remember that eta is exponentially in proper time. So it becoming zero exponentially fast, becoming classical. And that's as expected, since these wavelengths are becoming of very big size. And this happens during inflation and continues to become even more classical even after inflation, where the universe continues to expand. And indeed, we now see these fluctuations as being of cosmic size. So, good. Now, the... Right, so there is a lot of discussion on whether this is the right vacuum to choose. So this was the way I said it, it was an arbitrary choice. And I mentioned the analogy to Minkowski space, that we want the observer in the sitter to feel as if he was in Minkowski space. But, well, maybe those are not the right rules. And we don't know. We don't know the theories of quantum gravity well enough to know whether these are the right rules. So this is just a rule, and we'll follow this rule. And well, that's the simplest thing we could say. It's a rule that is self-consistent. You can compute corrections due to interactions using this rule. And the corrections work. I mean, they give finite answers. If you were to choose a different vacuum, so there are other de Sitter invariant vacua that you could choose. Maybe I shouldn't call them vacua. De Sitter invariant states that you could choose. And in those states, the local Minkowski observer will not feel as if he was in the vacuum. And when you try to compute corrections, you typically find divergent answers. And as far as I know, there are no, well, maybe there's some way to go around those, but I don't know of it. The most straightforward way of doing computations just gives you infinite answers. Plus the fact that the universe continues to expand today, right? And we feel we are more or less in the vacuum. So we don't see very high energy modes around our vacuum now. I mean, we are entering a period of inflation, so we have a cosmological constant. We are in approximately the Sitter space again, and we are not seeing anything special. So if we are not seeing anything special now, why? It's natural to assume this, so it's a simple assumption. And in some sense, it's an assumption which we make even when we do physics in flat space, right? So in flat space, we assume there are no excited modes. And the mathematics of how you implement this condition, maybe I was going to talk about that a bit later, but the mathematical statement is more or less equivalent to this I epsilon prescription, where we say that when we go to early times, we deform the contour of the integration in the path integral, this time contour. We move it slightly into the Euclidean domain, into the Euclidean time, and that in such a way that it dumps high energy states. And that is a prescription that works in the sense that it produces a reasonable perturbation theory. Now, presumably, this should be justified from a full theory of quantum gravity. And you can question it. So you can say, well, look, in the case of black holes, people are claiming they are firewalls and things like this. If there is a firewall here at the cosmological horizon, this is completely changed. But well, again, we are in the Sitter space now. We don't see any firewall. Inflation, yeah. Now you could say, well, maybe we are in a young the Sitter space. The firewalls haven't formed yet. So you can say all the things like this. But from the point of view of this calculation, I'm going to simply treat this as an assumption. So I'm going to assume that this is the vacuum we're going to consider, and that's part of the theory. So when we say the theory of production of cosmological fluctuations is both this type of Lagrangians and this choice of vacuum. Okay. Yes. Eta? Yeah. So what is related to the wavelength is this k, right? Yeah. And then we looked at the Penrose diagram. We went here and we looked at the Penrose diagram, right? And so this direction is x and this direction is eta, right? And we simply noted that, as we said, so this length is well defined in terms of k, right? And then we notice that when the wavelength crosses the horizon, it crosses the horizon at the time eta, which is equal to lambda. Okay. Well, eta has the same units as x, right? So they appear in the metric. You very well notice that if I rescale eta and x by some constant, the metric doesn't change, right? So the metric has an isometry and the rescaling of both eta and x, right? That's one of the symmetries of the Sitter space. And what you are observing is that whatever answer I get, it should be invariant under this rescaling. And indeed, this calculation, produces a spectrum of fluctuations which is scale invariant. And part of the exercise this afternoon is to actually plot this in position in the phi distribution and notice that it's scale invariant. And if you're really good with computers, you will be able to draw it with lots of resolution and then magnify. I haven't been able to do it myself, but I'm sure you can do it. So this k cubed here, this looks like it depends on k. But this dependence of k is just what is required by scale invariance. Okay? So it's not, it simply came from the Fourier transform. So to be a little more precise, so phi had no units. That means that when you do the Fourier transform, the phi k has units of 1 over k to the third power. And so whatever this answer gives us should have units of 1 over k to the sixth power. And the reason that that doesn't seem too much is because there is the delta of k plus k prime here. So that's the full answer if I put general momenta. K and k prime will have a delta function. That's 3 units in the denominator of k, and then this is the other 3. So that's just given by that scale invariance condition. And if we did the follows if we have a massless field. So if we had a massive field, then scale invariance continues to be operating, but it's realized in a slightly more complicated way because these results will be time dependent. So here there will be some dependence on time that will imply some dependence of time, and then the dependence on k is fixed by that dependence on time, by the same argument that we just made. Maybe we'll talk more about that tomorrow. But for now, let's consider the massless field. OK. Now, one more comment about this issue of the choice of vacuum. So with this prescription of choosing the vacuum in the same way that we choose it in Minkowski space, we cannot independently change the Lagrangian and change the vacuum. So, for example, if we had We say, well, we had our original Lagrangian that contained the gradient of phi squared, and now we add an interaction well, for example, phi cubed or something like this. Then the phi cubed, of course, leads to interactions among the fields. But you might also have said, well, I also changed the vacuum. So it's not the Gaussian anymore. It's something which is non-Gaussian, and I can change it arbitrarily. So that is not what happens when you choose this I epsilon prescription, because the vacuum is produced by integrating over time. And if you're interested in this time, then you do the path integral, and you move a little bit in Euclidean signature. And the same Lagrangian that you use with this phi cubed vertex, you integrate it both in Lorentzian time and Euclidean time to produce the vacuum. And so the changes of the state are not independent of the changes of the Lagrangian. Okay? This is also what we do in four-dimensional field theory, I mean, in ordinary flat space field theory. And this has experimental consequences. So let me just mention one interesting one. So let's go here to a clean part of the blackboard. So if you look at the three-point function, so it's characterized by three momenta, k1, k2, and k3, which should sum up to zero by overall translation symmetry. And then if you consider configurations whose momenta are close to aligned, right? So you have a k3, which is almost the same as the sum of k1 plus k2. So if you do not have this adiabatic vacuum we've been talking about, then the correlation function could peak and could have even infinite peaks in this regime. But if you have the adiabatic vacuum, you can go to this regime and the correlation function will be completely smooth. So the absence of any singularity in this regime is evidence for this adiabatic vacuum. Okay. And of course, well, this could be tested with the data. I don't know where exactly the bounds are today, but suddenly it's not infinite. In this regime. But looking at the three-point function in this regime is a way to see whether you had modes. I mean, the interpretation of this is that you get these large values if you had the mode k3 already in the vacuum, and then this phi cubed interaction splits it into two, right? So that's some evidence that you already had the mode k3. But if you started with the adiabatic vacuum, you didn't have any of the modes. And then to go to a situation like this, you would be violating energy conservation in the adiabatic vacuum at very early times. So you cannot have this splitting at very early times. Is that clear? Well, that's this question of if we do, yeah, so if we consider this alpha vacua and you try to do this three-point function calculation, you start getting infinities in these regimes. So maybe there is some new way of doing the calculation that people haven't discussed. But when they did the calculation, they found infinities. OK, so that's that story. Good. So now, of course, if you wanted to go to position space, you wanted to calculate the position space distribution. You have this 1 over k cubed, and you need to phi k prime. And then you need to construct. So this tells you what the amplitude of the variance of each. Of the amplitude, so think of phi of k as some random number whose variance is given by 1 over k cubed. And then you just do the inverse Fourier transform. So you take phi of x will be equal to the integral d cubed of this phi of k e to the I kx. Right, so this will be some random numbers that you can generate, and then you can plot now this phi of x, and that will be the scale invariant distribution. Okay. So far I've discussed a scalar field in a scalar field. I will now discuss a little bit more how this works in inflation. I have until 12. Is that the plan?
Yeah.
12 minutes. OK. So inflation calculation is very similar. So let me go through the difference. So in inflation, is the idea that the universe was described at some early time by gravity plus a scalar field with a potential. And there is a period of so you can solve first for the homogeneous solutions, so phi of t and a metric, which is minus dt squared plus e to the 2 rho of t d cubed x, right? So d squared x. So you have this metric, and you can solve for the equations of motion for the metric. And I think one of the exercises was to calculate the equations of motion, so I won't write them down. But those are the equations of motion for the metric. Well, maybe I'll. And if certain parameters are small, then so-called slow roll parameters, then so if epsilon, which is, well, maybe I'll write one of the equations. So I will write down this equation. So inflation is the regime in which you can essentially neglect this time derivative compared to the potential. And in that regime, the Hubble will be proportional to the potential. And if the gradient of the potential is not too big, so if it is small enough, then that approximation will be correct and will stay correct for a while. And this happens if some parameters are small. So if the derivative of the potential in units of M Planck are very small, means a few percent, then this is one of the conditions. And then there is a second condition, which is roughly what the mass of the field is in Hubble units. So that has to do with the second derivative of the potential. So if both conditions are very small, then there is a period of inflation. And you in one of the exercises, we just take a very simple potential, like m squared phi squared. And with a potential of this kind, you get inflation. So you don't have to have very elaborate potentials. Now, there is a sense in which this potential is rather elaborate, but I won't elaborate on that. Anyway, this potential is ruled out by observations, by the way. But it was the last one to be ruled out. Well, the last one so far. The idea is, but it's useful, it's nice to put this simple potential, and you solve these equations, and you find that the universe expands exponentially for a while, and then when this term becomes comparable to that one, the field starts oscillating in this harmonic oscillator potential, and the universe becomes matter-dominated, and you'll be able to see this in the solution of this simple ordinary differential equation. And then this field is supposed to decay to the standard model fields. There should be some coupling between this field and this field is called the inflaton and the standard model fields. And that will reheat the universe, will create radiation and so on at high temperatures. And then we'll have the ordinary Big Bang evolution. Okay, so that's the idea. And this whole decay process should occur before nucleosynthesis, because nucleosynthesis predictions are in agreement with experiment. And whatever this does, it should happen before that. OK. So now let's consider the non-uniform case. So we'll consider perturbations of this solution. And there are perturbations in both the scalar field or the expansion factor, or many other of the components of the metric. So in general, it's a little bit, looks at first a little bit complicated, but it's simple in principle. So we had our uniform rho of t And then we can have some fluctuation, which depends on t and x. We also had our scalar field, which was some uniform solution, phi of t. But now we can have some fluctuation, which also depends on t and x. Okay. Because we're doing a theory of gravity, we also have some reparametrization symmetries. And so it could happen that we could have a perfectly uniform solution, but it might not look uniform because we just chose a slice in the time direction, which is not uniform, right? So that can also happen. So in general, if we take time and we make a time reparametrization, which is tau of x and t, right? So here we just simply change the time to a new time. We can call it t prime. Then we'll induce some fluctuations, which will have some specific forms. So under a fluctuation of this kind, so we'll be adding here some other fluctuations, which will be of the form, for example, rho dot times this tau, or phi dot times this tau. Right? This is to first order in tau. So phi dot is the derivative of the homogeneous solution, and this also is a homogeneous solution. So by making time reparametrizations, we can induce these fake fluctuations. So we're only interested in the real physical fluctuations. And so for that, we can choose a gauge. So we can set one of these two to zero, for example, and use the reparametrizations to set one of them to zero, and then consider the other one to be physical. I'm slightly oversimplifying because there are 10 degrees of freedom in the metric plus 1 degree of freedom in phi. And so we have 11 functions. We really have not only the time reparametrization, but also the spatial reparametrization. So there are 4 degrees of freedom of reparametrizations. So let me do this quick counting. So we have 10 plus 1 functions. We have 4 reparametrizations. So we can fix 4 gauge constraints. We can use these 4 to remove 4 of the degrees of freedom. But when we look at systems with gauge symmetries, we typically find that 4 of the equations, or one of the equations per degree of freedom, well, for each degree of freedom, we'll have one extra constraint, so one equation of motion which will not be dynamical. Constraints. That's what happens, for example, in electromagnetism, where you have, let's say, in 4 dimensions, you have 4 components of A mu. And you can, by gauge choice, you can remove one of them. But then the second one is removed by, let's say, the Gauss law or one of the Maxwell equations. The same happens here. So we remove 8. And we are left with 3 degrees of freedom. And these 3 degrees of freedom are 2 have a spin 2 and correspond to the gravity waves. And 1 has spin 0. And the spin 0 piece is, you might think of the spin 0 as essentially the phi that we had originally, but it's really a mixture of the phi and the metric. Okay. And depending on the gauge you choose, it could be purely from the metric or purely from phi. So it's really from both of them. One useful way to think about inflations or side comment is that this phi can be viewed as a clock. So it's useful to view this phi as a clock, which tells us when inflation is going to end. So inflation ends when phi, when the slow roll condition ceases to be valid. And so really, we have this physical clock. And these fluctuations we are describing are fluctuations in this physical clock. And this model of a scalar field is one model for this physical clock, but there could be others in principle. OK, so so one choice based on this physical clock discussion would be to say that we set delta phi equal to 0 by a gauge choice. And then the fluctuations would be of the form delta rho. So that's sometimes called, so this in this gauge, sometimes called the zeta gauge or the curvature gauge. So sometimes people define this coordinate zeta, which is defined to be the fluctuation in the scale factor when we set delta phi equal to 0. But we can also choose other gauges. We could have considered no fluctuation in the metric, and then think of delta phi as the physical field. And these two gauge choices are useful for during different times. And so I'm going to describe the calculation using both gauge choices and their transformations. Now, normally the people say you shouldn't change horses mid-race, right? Now, this is one situation where it's useful to change horses mid-race. So first we'll use the second horse, okay? And using the, so with the second horse, so the metric is essentially has no fluctuations and can be approximated by the metric of the Sitter space. And for that reason, the computation and the field also can be approximated by a massless field in the Sitter space. And for that reason, the calculation of the fluctuations. So we're going to apply this for in the following way. So we're going to follow a specific wavelength. And when the wavelength is much more than the Hubble size, so it crosses the Hubble size at this time, when it's much smaller, we use this WKB approximation, or the adiabatic vacuum approximation. We continue to use that. That adiabatic vacuum approximation breaks down during these times, okay, when it crosses the horizon. There, we will make the approximation that we are in a pure de Sitter space, and that we have a massless scalar field in the Sitter space. And that will compute these fluctuations of delta phi. And we'll get, for delta phi, a value of h squared over 2k cubed. Okay. This factor of h squared you can get using the same calculation I did before. I was setting it before to 1, but it just propagates in a simple way through the formulas. The reason to change gauge is that if you continue to use this phi, since there is the potential, if you had a constant fluctuation here, delta phi, the potential will exert a force and will change the value of this fluctuation. And so it's convenient to choose the gauge to zeta. So we're going to change gauges. And so in this region, we'll use the gauge where delta phi is the degree of freedom and delta rho is 0. And here we'll use the gauge where delta phi is 0. And delta rho is what we were defining as zeta. And the advantage of these variables is that when the mode is outside the horizon, zeta is constant. Outside the horizon. Now, the reason it is constant is that first of all, in this gauge, phi is really measuring the proper time. I mean, it's measuring the real physical time in the sense that phi is going to determine when inflation ends. It's really telling you what's intrinsically going on. Okay. So if we have a big fluctuation here, so if we look at some region here, well, phi is really what's determining how long we are left till inflation ends and so on. And zeta at these very long distances, so if we have a very long distance fluctuation in zeta, recall the form of the metric, which was e to the 2 rho plus, let's say, 2 zeta d squared x. If we have a very long distance fluctuation, it can almost be removed by a rescaling of x. So if this was just constant, then we could just remove, if zeta was constant, we can remove it by a rescaling of x. And then it's completely unphysical, as I was being asked before, that the units of x don't matter and so on. So then we could just remove it and then evolve for a while and then put it back again doing the inverse coordinate transformation. And that shows that it shouldn't depend in time. This argument was a little quick, but at least it makes it plausible, okay? Because it's something that is almost like a pure gauge transformation. And it would be a gauge transformation as long as we can neglect the spatial derivatives. And we can do that when we are outside the horizon. When the mode enters the horizon again in the future, So here it enters the horizon again. Now this is in the radiation dominated, for example, or Big Bang phase. Then we cannot assume that zeta is constant again, and zeta will start changing again. Okay. But anyway, so the zeta is constant. I'm almost done. Don't worry. We want to write down the equation for the two-point function of the zeta variable. And all we need to do is to do the change of gauge. So it's, we essentially have the formulas here. So if we had initially a gauge where the first thing was constant and the first thing was zero, so we had initially, so let me write delta phi and delta rho, okay? So initially we had something which was some delta phi and zero, okay? And we want to add some time reparametrization that removes this and creates something here, right? What should be that time reparametrization? Well, we want to cancel this, so we want this time reparametrization to be minus 1 over phi dot, okay? Delta phi, so the delta phi that we had divided by phi dot, if we choose that to be time, we cancel this, but we create something in zeta. And what we create in zeta is, so now we'll have something which is zero in the phi direction, and here the zeta will be equal to whatever we created using this, which will be rho dot minus rho dot over phi dot times the delta phi, okay? So if we know the two-point function of delta phi, then we can calculate the two-point function of delta zeta, and we'll get this formula saying that this is phi squared over rho dot squared times h squared over 2k cubed. So this was the computation of the delta phi two-point function, and then this this is the time derivative of the uniform solution. And we do this change of gauge just after we cross the horizon. So this will be evaluated at the time that we cross the horizon. So t star is the time where we cross the horizon. And this time depends on k. So there is a time defined by the equation this equal to 1, right? So this is a time of order 1 over k, so the conformal time of order 1 over k. And that leads to some extra k dependence that will be a little smaller. I mean, in general, if in slow roll inflation, it will be a little slower than this k cubed or the scale invariant answer. And this predicts a slight variation, deviation from scale invariance, which has been, so the deviation from scale invariance has been seen in experiment, and it's of the order of 4%, okay? So where 100% is a factor of 1, yeah, so. So there's a 4% deviation from the scale invariant answer. So this has been seen in the CMB experiments. Yeah, so let me try to say. 1 over k cubed is the same as essentially scale invariance. Sometimes, so that in the CL plot would be this, okay? So it would be nothing. So in the CMB plots, when people plot it, they typically have something like this. This is due to some extra physics that takes the scale invariant answer and does this, okay? Yeah, so this piece here is just multiplied by KQ. Yeah. Yeah, if you look very closely, they normally plot CL times L squared. Yeah, that's the same as the. Yeah. Sometimes people, when they talk about this, they don't even put the k cubed. But then I find that discussion not so clear because they don't say exactly what they are computing. Well, they say, but it's not really the Fourier modes of the distribution. So I prefer to say that we have the Fourier modes of the distribution. And those Fourier modes have the 1 over k cubed determined essentially by dimensional, by scale invariance. And then there could be some extra factor, which is sometimes called, so this extra factor is sometimes called, you can write it as k over some k naught to the power ns minus 1. And so this is a small number of order 0.004. 0.04. That's this number. For historical reasons, it's measured from 1. It was a bad choice, but it perpetrated in the literature. Sorry. It's not my fault. OK, and one more little thing is that, it was in the exercises, so that's why I will mention it. So you can actually, so here I derived this formula from a slightly hand-waving argument, this argument about changing the gauge and so on. You can take all the original Einstein equations with the scalar field, and you can choose a gauge, and then work through that gauge choice and derive an effective action for this single scalar degree of freedom. And if you choose your scalar degree of freedom to be the zeta variable in the gauge we just mentioned, where delta phi is equal to 0, you need some other gauge choices I'm not describing right now, but because there are 4 gauge. So you end up with an action which has the final form, which is a rather, I mean, it's fairly simple, considering if you try to derive it, you find that the derivation is quite a mess. And I encourage you to find a simpler derivation of this formula. But the final formula is rather simple. This is just a quadratic order. So here there are order zeta cubed, which is even more messy to derive. So with this action, then now you are in business to calculate these fluctuations for any inflation model. So someone gives you an inflation model, you calculate the uniform solution. So you calculate the solution for phi dot and rho dot, right? So that's solving the uniform equations. And once you find that solution, you plug it in here, you calculate the wave equation for this, and you start at very early times with the WKB approximation, and you see what constant they become later. And that will determine the spectrum of fluctuations in general, right, for any potential. And you will find that it is well approximated by this formula, if for many cases. For cases where we are very close to the slow roll condition, when the slow roll conditions are close to being satisfied, it will be well approximated by that. I think I'll finish here. Thank you. Yeah.